Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Beau Fernald, Vice Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce Beth Shapiro. She is Associate Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her research aims to better understand how populations and species change through time by using the most recent experimental and computational approaches to analyze genetic information. In particular, she focuses on the evolutionary processes of speciation and extinction. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including the journals Nature and Science, and she was a 2009 MacArthur Fellow. Please welcome Beth Shapiro.
Hi. Well, I'm kind of short, so I'm going to pick this up and step out from beside this thing because I always feel like it's really hard to see me. Anyway, thank you so much for coming today. I really do appreciate you guys coming out and taking – it's a beautiful day outside, so you have no excuse for not being outside enjoying the weather other than coming here to listen to me. So hopefully I will make it worth your while. Nervous. So as Beau said, when he introduced me, I'm a biologist. I work at UC Santa Cruz. I'm also sometimes called a geneticist or a paleogeneticist or sometimes a bioinformatician. All of these things kind of mean the same thing. My research in my lab at UC Santa Cruz really focuses on climate change, and this might come as a little bit of a surprise given the title of the book and the introduction and the fact that I'm a geneticist. So when we think about climate change today, if we hear or see stories about climate change, often what we see are images like this one, where we're learning about how changes in weather patterns are causing a redistribution of the amount of water that we see in different places. This is not California, but many of us fear that California might look like this at some point in future. And we know that as these weather pattern changes, some places get very dry, other places get very wet. We see lots of storms that are coming in more and more frequency and causing lots of damage to different places on the coasts and elsewhere. And of course, there are species that are being pushed to the brink of extinction. And if we read about climate change in kind of journals and magazines, often what we see are headlines like these, where we're just told that we should be very, very scared because horrible things are happening. But as a scientist, what we might actually want to ask and start to learn is how species and communities and ecosystems that exist today are going to change as a consequence of these changes in weather patterns and other effects of climate change. If you read the scientific literature at all about climate change, one of the most common graphs that you see is this one right here. This is often called a hockey stick graph because it looks like a hockey stick on its side with the long end here and the short end up there. And what this is a plot of average global temperatures over the last 1,000 or so years. And the black line in the middle there is the average global temperature around 1960. So what you see is that over 1,000 years, the average global temperature was about the same, pretty constant, maybe declining a tiny little bit. And then in the last 100 years or so, rocketed up several degrees Celsius. And this plot can be extended forward in time, and we see that there's projections of increased global warming on the range of 4 to 5 to sometimes even 8 degrees. But this is not the first time in Earth's history that we've experienced a very rapid global warming event. And if we extend this plot backward through time, and this is the same kind of reconstruction, looking at average global temperatures, but now over the last about 1 million years. No, sorry, this is 100,000 years. Sorry, 100,000 years. So what we see here is an ice age. This is a very cold point in Earth's history. And then here, this is called an interstadial, where there's lots of fluctuations between cold and warm. This right here is the peak of the last ice age, a very cold period. That was about 20,000 years ago. And then a very rapid warming event that happened as we transitioned out of the last ice age and into the warm Holocene. Now, this is not meant to say that the period of warming that we're experiencing today is not remarkably different in some way, but just to say that there have been past past periods of rapid global warming that have been equally intense to what we've seen, if not necessarily what's predicted to happen in future. So what I do is I actually go back in time and extract DNA from animals that lived across this 100,000-year interval and ask how they responded to these past periods of climate change, with the hope that we can use what we learn to make more informed decisions about how to use the limited resources we have to deal with the changes that are going to happen as a consequence of climate change that's happening in the present day. So I work in a field called ancient DNA. It's pretty self-explanatory. It means DNA that's old, not necessarily old like grandma's DNA, but DNA that's like 100,000, even up to 700,000 years old. I work mostly in Beringia. That's this part of the world here that connects. This is North America here. And this here, if you remember, several years ago, this was said to be the part of the world that Sarah Palin can see from her backyard. Remember that? Yeah. So you notice that, that there's some light coloration here, and that's because the seas are actually more shallow there than they are elsewhere in the world. So during ice ages, when much of the planet's water was taken up into forming glaciers that sat on top of the continents, the sea level was lower, and that whole area was exposed. It was actually a land bridge connecting the two continents, and lots of different animal and plant species moved in both directions. Horses and camels moved from North America into Asia, and things like bison and people move from Asia into North America. So it's a very important conduit for exchange. And it's also cold, and it's cold there today, which means that the remains of these organisms survive very well, and as does the DNA within their remains. So today, Beringia looks a bit like this. I'm actually in this helicopter taking the picture of the ground there. This is in north-central Siberia in the Taimyr Peninsula. But during the Ice Age and prior to the Ice Age, it looked more like this, with a very diverse grassland that was fed upon by a diverse community of herbivores like mammoths and mastodons and woolly rhinos in Asia. And they were fed upon by an equally diverse community of carnivores like lions. We had saber-toothed cats and cave lions. Giant bears that stood 16 feet tall called Arctidus. They lived right here in California until around 8,000 years ago. So we fly out into this amazing landscape. Here I am, standing next to the helicopter that I was taking pictures of. You'll notice that there are some windows missing in this helicopter. That was actually a good thing because it made smoking on board easier as you were sitting on top of the gas tanks. I certainly did not participate in that. Although I was shaking considerably the entire time we were up there. Yes, very scary. We stay in 5-star accommodation like this. This picture I took by backing away from my tent and slightly unfocusing the camera so you could get a feel for the depth of mosquitoes that were present in the environment. There you go. And we wander around. This is the place in the Yukon Territory near Dawson City, where there's a lot of active gold mining going on. This is actually a process called placer mining, where the miners pump this water after the spring thaw into these holding ponds and then spray it against the permafrost, the frozen dirt. And they're trying to wash that permafrost away to get to the gold-bearing gravels beneath. And as they do, hundreds to thousands of bones from animals that lived during the Ice Age come washing out of this permafrost, many of them still frozen from the day that they were deposited, which means that the DNA in these bones is in remarkably good shape. So we wander along and collect the bones as they come out of the permafrost. And in a day of collecting around Dawson City, we'll get somewhere between 20 and maybe 50 bags like this filled with bones. And this is mostly horses and mammoth and bison and caribou. These are the four most abundant herbivore species in the Klondike. And we cut a little chunk out of them and take it back to the lab and extract DNA. And then we can correlate the amount of genetic diversity that we see through time in any of these populations, or any of these species, with how big those populations are. And we've actually learned quite a lot about how these animals and plants have responded to climate change in over the last at least 50,000 years or so, where we have the majority of our data. We've seen, for example, that herbivores, bison, horses, and mammoths, increased in size during the approach to the last glacial maximum and began to decline toward extinction well before people first arrived in North America, suggesting that we are not responsible for the initial stages of their decline toward extinction, although I'm not quite willing to let us off the hook for eventually driving them to extinction in the end. We've seen populations of carnivores like bears expand and grow and move across landscapes relatively quickly, presumably in response to growing numbers of herbivores that they can eat. And we're starting to learn why some species like caribou have done very well, while other species like cave lion went extinct. And we publish this stuff in lots of high-profile journals. We get a lot of attention. Sometimes my mom is even interested. She reads about it in the news and calls me up. And yet the thing, the only thing that everybody really wants to know when they call me to talk about our research, which I'm always excited to talk about, how we can actually make, so we can help make decisions about present-day climate change, they only ever really want to know one thing. And that is why I wrote this book. So that brings us to the topic of the conversation today. De-extinction is the grammatically unfortunate word, and you have to admit that it is. I mean, how do you conjugate this for real without feeling really disgusting about what you've just said, right? De-extinction has come to mean bringing species or maybe even traits or, and we can get into this a little bit, back to life. And this is a subject that we all know quite a bit about. We were there the first time it happened. We remember how well it went. So, of course, we're not worried about it at all this time around, right? So the idea behind Jurassic Park there was that that dinosaur DNA was preserved in insects that were themselves preserved in amber, and that scientists were able to grind up these pieces of amber and extract the DNA from dinosaurs from inside these insects and use that to recreate dinosaurs. It turns out that amber is a particularly poor source of DNA. It's very porous. It means lots of bacteria can get in there and just chew up that DNA. But dinosaurs are actually very old. They've been extinct for more than 65 million years, and that is well beyond when we think that any DNA can survive. The oldest DNA that we've been able to recover is about 700,000 years old, and that's from a piece of ice that was 700,000 years old. So if there isn't any ice, there's probably not going to be any DNA. Dinosaur bones themselves, because they're fossils, are actually rocks. Rocks don't have DNA, which means that we're not going to clone dinosaurs. Sorry. Of course, mammoth bones are not rocks. In fact, we have seen very many incredibly well-preserved mammoth remains coming out of the permafrost, that frozen dirt in both Siberia and Alaska, which is why when we talk about de-extinction, most people like to talk about things like mammoths. Now, I like to call myself, when we talk about de-extinction, an enthusiastic skeptic. So you'll see in the course of the next 20 or so minutes that there are many steps in de-extinction that I don't think are feasible right now, that I have ethical or ecological problems with. However, I am going to come around in the end and tell you why I am enthusiastic about this approach. So bear with me as I walk through what might come across as an overwhelmingly slightly negative view on how this would actually happen. So plan A, when we first think about cloning a mammoth, the thing that comes to mind is cloning, obviously. But cloning is a very specific scientific technology that's called somatic cell nuclear transfer. So in our bodies, we basically have two types of cells, germ cells, which are sperm and eggs, and somatic cells, which are everything else. What normally happens is that a sperm and an egg come together, fuse, create a zygote. That cells, the cells in that early stage embryo, have a special property where they can divide and differentiate and eventually become every type of somatic cell that makes up an entire organism. Heart cells, skin cells, hair cells, muscle cells, these are all different types of somatic cells, each with a different set of instructions about which genes should be turned and off in order to make that type of cell. Obviously, a heart cell has a different set of instructions than a hair cell, so we need to be able to differentiate into these things. Once you're a somatic cell with a particular job to do, it's impossible to turn around, to revert to becoming something that could have a different job. And this is where cloning comes in. So the most famous example of cloning is Dolly the sheep. This is the creation of a sheep in the mid-1990s by a group of scientists at the Roslin Institute in Scotland. What they did was they took a somatic cell, a mammary cell, from a sheep, a particular breed of ewe, and they took those cells and they stuck them in a dish in a lab and starved them of nutrients. stressed him out. At the same time, they took an egg cell from a different breed of ewe, and they removed the genetic material from that egg cell, the material that would go on to be fertilized by a sperm and then be able to become every type of cell in the body. They stuck this stressed-out somatic cell next to the egg cell that had had its own genetic material removed, zapped him with a bit of electricity. It caused the membrane to rupture here and this genetic material to dump into that egg cell. And then they zapped it again, and the proteins that are in that egg cell caused that somatic cell to revert, to turn around and become one of those early stage embryonic cells that had the capacity to become every type of cell in a body. In cloning, a somatic cell forgets its job, forgets how to be that somatic cell, and becomes the same type of cell that can turn into a whole organism. From that, the developmental process ensued. They implanted a developing embryo in yet another breed of you. It's not important that they were different breeds. This cloning process can work with the same breed, but the scientists here wanted to make sure that when Dolly was born, she was a genetic clone and physically identical to the donor of the somatic tissue and not to the egg tissue, the egg donor, or to the surrogate mom. So how would this work with a mammoth? So we go out into the field and we find a really well-preserved mammoth and we find some somatic cells and we take them out and we put them in a dish in a lab and stress them out as they're growing. We implant them into an egg cell. That magical thing happens and we implant it into an elephant. It grows up into a baby. It's born into the forest and lives happily ever after. Pretty straightforward, right? So here we have our first problem. So we do find very, very many wonderfully well-preserved mammoth remains in the field and from other animals that lived at least during the last ice ages, especially during periods when it was cold. We have all these bones that we found here. They're incredibly well-preserved mummies. And a few years ago, there was this really well-preserved mummy that was found in the New Siberian Islands that you may have heard about. It was in the news. It was thought to have been associated with a thick, red, viscous substance that some people were suggesting might be blood. I've been told since then that it's not blood. It was actually described to me as corpse juice, which sounds really gross, but blood would have been more exciting. But regardless of this, none of these things, no matter how remarkably well-preserved they are going to have any living cells. When an organism dies, the DNA within every one of its cells and the cells themselves start to be broken down almost immediately. First, because of enzymes that are in the body chopping up DNA. Normally, DNA repair can happen in our cells when our DNA gets broken by things like UV radiation or oxidation or hydrolysis. We have repair mechanisms that come along and fix those damaged sites. But DNA repair is energy requiring. And once an organism is dead, there's no more energy being made and DNA repair stops. So the process of breaking the cell down begins almost immediately. And that means that we're never going to find any living cells from anything that is extinct and has been for a long time. And if we can't find any living cells, we cannot clone something by somatic cell nuclear transfer. Thank you for coming. Just kidding. All right, so we can't clone anything by somatic cell nuclear transfer, but there must be another way that we could bring these things back to life. Now, I work in ancient DNA. We go out in the field and we grind up bones and we extract genetic information from those bones. We know that some of these bones are incredibly well preserved. So surely we could just take that genetic information that we've extracted and piece together those long strands of A's, C's, G's, and T's, the letters of DNA that make up the genomes that contain the genes that make the proteins that make an animal look and act like that particular animal. All we'd have to do then is take that strung together sequence of A's, C's, G's, and T's. In the case of a mammoth, that's about 4 to 4.5 billion letters that we would piece together and stick them into chromosomes. And then we stick those chromosomes into a cell that we're growing up in a dish in a lab. And then we can do this whole thing about how we're bringing this animal back to life. So So there are two main challenges associated with sequencing and assembling genomes from extinct species. The first is that the DNA sequences that we can recover from these animals are very short and very damaged. And that's because of these processes that I was talking about before. Enzymatic decay. Bacteria in the soil where the bones or mummies are buried getting into that bone and chewing up the DNA because they're just catabolizing anything that can give them energy. And then solar radiation, oxidation, water getting into these things. All of these things are very bad for DNA survival. So if you imagine that, if I were working with modern tissue, I could sequence long strands of DNA that were reminiscent of party streamers. What we get out of mammoth bones is more like confetti. But when I was looking on Google Images to try to figure out if I could find the right image of confetti, I couldn't actually find any confetti that was like from the day after the parade, you know? Like brushed into the gutter when it had rained the night before and there were mammoths in the parade and a flock of passenger pigeons flying. Anyway, it's really bad, right? The stuff is really damaged and really short and incredibly fragmented. The second problem is that when we extract DNA from bones that have buried in, that have been buried in the ground, the DNA from the organism whose bone it is not the only DNA that we recover. So if I were to take a piece of my hair or a swab from the inside of my cheek and extract DNA and sequence everything that I was able to extract, I might be able to sequence billions and billions of fragments, and then I would compare each of those sequences one at a time to this large online database that exists of everything that's ever been sequenced. Pretty much everything that we got out of that extract would map to the human genome. Because I'm a human, I'm modern, most of the DNA in me is actually my DNA. And this is the way that that would look, where the red is my DNA and the blue is anything else, bacterial sequence perhaps. I was involved about 10 years ago with the first attempt to do this with a mammoth bone. We took a mammoth bone from Siberia, and we ground it up, and we extracted DNA, and then we sequenced everything that we'd extracted from that DNA. And that gave us several billion fragments that we, again, compared to this massive database of everything that's ever been sequenced. And about half of the fragments that we sequenced mapped to the elephant genome. And the other half was just other stuff. There was a bit of human DNA. There always is a bit of human DNA when we're extracting things. There's tons of human DNA in this room, and when you walk out, all of your DNA will be in here. Remember that if you ever try to commit a crime. There's tons of environmental DNA. You see here that the big chunk of what we actually extracted, we were not able to identify. That's probably also soil, bacterial, or microbial DNA. There's a lot of genetic diversity and evolutionary diversity in the soil that's unknown as of yet because it hasn't been sequenced yet. So it's not on the big public database. So when we have a fragment of it, it just comes up as unidentified. Anyway, about half of what we were able to get was mammoth DNA. And we were pretty bummed out about this. We thought if we have to throw away half of everything we produce, it's going to cost a fortune and take an incredibly long time to piece together a mammoth genome. In retrospect, we now know that this was an incredibly good specimen. That in fact, most of the remains that we can pick up from the permafrost have somewhere between 5 and 20% of the target species DNA. And if you guys heard of the Neanderthal genome sequencing project that was done by the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig, the bones that they used to sequence and assemble the first Neanderthal genome, there were several of them, none of them had more than 1% Neanderthal DNA in them. So they were throwing away 99% of the data that they collected because it wasn't useful in making the Neanderthal DNA. All the genetic material to assemble the genome is in those bones. You just have to sequence it a lot if you're actually going to throw away 99% of the data that you're generating. So you not only have dirty, disgusting, gross day after the parade confetti, but you're actually just trying to find the purple bits in there, Rainey. So the way we do this is we map the genomes to the genomes of living species. So in order to sequence and assemble the Neanderthal genome, you use the human genome as a template. And you take each of those tiny little broken fragments of Neanderthal DNA and you line it up against the entire human genome and figure out where it fits in best. And you do that with every single piece that you've brought out of that Neanderthal bone. And eventually you will come up with the Neanderthal genome. The same is true for the mammoth. Now we have the Asian elephant and the African elephant genomes. We can take all the little tiny sequences of mammoth DNA and line them up against the elephant genomes and figure out where they go. Of course, even if we could piece together this entire sequence, which we can't really do yet, although the technology for stringing together long fragments of DNA is getting better, that's not the same thing as actually having a living cell. In fact, while we're getting better at sequencing DNA, we don't know how to wrap those DNA sequences up into chromosomes in such a way that the genes will actually turn on and off. And we don't know how to stick entirely new chromosomes inside cells. So if sequencing the mammoth is the way that we're going to bring them back to life, we're actually kind of stuck on step one. Fortunately, there is yet another way that we might consider bringing mammoths back to life. And this is actually the technology that one would probably use to bring an extinct species back to life, or for any of the other, and I think remarkably exciting, technologies that are being developed with the same sort of approach that might be used to bring an extinct species back to life. And that is to engineer a mammoth. And as a very simplistic overview of what might happen, imagine this as a kind of cut and paste job. We sequence and assemble the mammoth genome. We already have the elephant genome. We compare the two and figure out where they're different. And then we take an elephant cell that contains an elephant genome, and we cut out the bits of that elephant genome where the mammoths are different and paste the mammoth version in their place. So we know that there have been about 5 or 6 million years of evolutionary difference between mammoths and Asian elephants. And we now have several Asian elephant genomes and several mammoth genomes. And what's really important to keep in mind at this point is that Asian elephants and mammoths, because there's only 5 or 6 million years of difference between them, are about 99% identical already at the level of their genomes. So if we want to do this cut and paste job, all we have to do is identify that remaining 1% and figure out what 1% genetic differences, and this is like a million or a million and a half differences, are actually important between the two species, and then cut out the elephant version and paste in the mammoth version in its place. So imagine that you had a little robot that you could program to go to a very specific place in the elephant genome. You could send this robot into a cell growing in a dish in a lab, and it would go throughout that genome, wandering around the chromosomes, and grab a hold of it exactly where you wanted to cut something out. And you could send that robot into the genome with a little package, and that package could be a small fragment of synthesized, from a lab, mammoth DNA. So a string of DNA that matches the elephant version that you want to cut out. Together, these two things can go into the genome, swim around, find the place to cut it out, chop it out, and stick that mammoth version back in. We have this robot, but it's not a robot. In fact, it's a real, living, naturally occurring enzyme, protein enzyme complex called CRISPR-Cas9. And CRISPR-Cas9 has been in the news a lot lately. You've probably heard about it. It's incredibly powerful and very scary, but we're going to concentrate right now on the positive applications of CRISPR-Cas9 for de-extinction and genetic rescue. So what this CRISPR-Cas9 molecule is it's a way that bacteria and archaea can defend against invading pathogens that might come into their own cells. So bacteria and archaea have this molecule, and it learns to recognize the exact specific sequence of different pathogens. And then it searches throughout that bacterial cell, and when it finds the pathogen, it cuts it up. So it does all the things we want it to do if we want to use this to cut and paste something into an actual living genome. But instead of a pathogen sequence, it's now looking for that exact part of the genome that we want to cut. So we send this CRISPR-Cas9 molecule into the cell along with our synthetic bit of mammoth DNA, and it runs along the genome till it finds exactly the right spot, and it grabs a hold of it there. That's that red line here, and then it cuts it in half. Now, your DNA doesn't like to be cut in half. It's not very good for a cell for DNA to be cut in half. It causes cancer and cell death often. So evolution has created a couple of different mechanisms to fix this type of break. So the next step would be to harness the cell's own mechanism for fixing breaks like this if they were to occur naturally. And in harnessing that mechanism, this synthetic mammoth version of the gene is pasted in where the DNA strands are cut. And then the animal that's born from that cell is an elephant, mostly an elephant genome, that is a tiny little bit mammoth-like. Right. So we have this technology. If we were going to use it to bring a mammoth back to life, what would we change? Well, in the about 6 million years of evolutionary divergence between Asian elephants and mammoths, as I've said, there have been about a million or a million and a half differences that have evolved. Not all of these are in coding parts of the genome that make proteins that change the way an animal looks or acts. So we might want to start with changes that are in genes. And one of the first differences to be identified was in red blood cells, a part of the red blood cell called hemoglobin. And a few years ago, a group of scientists in Manitoba, led by Kevin Campbell, discovered that there were exactly three differences in this particular part of the hemoglobin gene, which makes the red blood cells, between the woolly mammoth and its closest living relative, the Asian elephant. And they were curious what these three differences actually caused. So they made copies of each of these proteins in a cell and expressed them and said, what is the difference? And it turns out that this version of the hemoglobin protein, the woolly mammoth version, is much better than the Asian elephant version of this protein at carrying oxygen around the body when it's cold. So this is very clearly one of the potential adaptations that an Asian elephant would require if it were going to all of a sudden start living like a mammoth. So what else would we change? Well, scientists have begun to make lists of genetic differences between Asian elephants and mammoths. And there's a group at Harvard, led by George Church, that's actually started to use this CRISPR-Cas9 engineering to edit elephant genomes so that they contain 14 of these, they've been successful with so far, mammoth genes. And this is remarkably cool, I think, that they've been able to take these elephant cells growing in a dish in a lab and create something that is approximately a small amount mammoth, right? And of course, there's a huge difference between having cells growing in a dish in a lab and having an actual elephant that contains mammoth genes. And yet we are part of the way there. So if we look back at this particular flow chart here that I keep putting up, we do have the capacity to sequence and compare the genomes of Asian elephants and mammoths and identify the differences we want to create. We can actually change the genomes of Asian elephant cells growing in a dish in a lab so that they contain some of these mammoth genes. And that, of course, gives us a living elephant cell that we can clone using somatic cell nuclear transfer. And then what happens? Well, the next couple steps of de-extinction, we actually don't really know how to do yet. I like to call these steps phase two. And phase two receives a lot less attention in the popular press when they talk about de-extinction than phase one, where it's often assumed that because we have the genome and this editing way, all of a sudden we're going to see mammoths. Well, probably not, because there's a lot of stuff that has to happen here from a technical perspective initially, that would have to happen in order to actually bring a mammoth back to life. We don't really know how to do IVF in elephants. We don't really know what the consequences of a mammoth growing up inside the body of an elephant and being raised by elephants might be. And we don't really know what the ecological consequences of releasing elephants that are modified to have some mammoth genes into the environment might be. And yet this is a very important part of de-extinction. It's not being ignored by people who are in favor of this. People are thinking hard about how to overcome these technical and ecological challenges. But it does receive less attention when people are thinking about it. So what about phase two? And I'm just going to go through it briefly because I only have a few minutes of time left. First, we would need to identify an appropriate host. And here I'm stepping outside of mammoths for a minute, because there are many species that have been proposed as candidates for de-extinction, and some species that have very closely related living relatives, this step might be easier for, and other species where there aren't any closely related living relatives, this might be very hard to do. For a moa, for example, which is a very tall, extinct New Zealand bird, the closest living relative is a tinamou, and they shared a common ancestor more than 30 million years ago. This is a lot of evolutionary distance that would have to be overcome, and there's no knowledge of whether or not that would actually affect the capacity of a tinamou egg to be able to carry a moa. There may, in some cases, be size constraints, not necessarily with mammoths. It turns out that the late Pleistocene woolly mammoth was about the same size as living Asian elephants, so there probably wouldn't be a problem there. But imagine if you were trying to resurrect the stellar sea cow. That's this guy right here. The closest living relative of the stellar sea cow used to live off the coast here, all the way across the Aleutian Islands to the Commanders. Went extinct a couple hundred years ago because one of these would feed a crew of many, many men for many, many weeks. They were very big. Their closest living relative are dugongs and manatees. If the size ratio between newborn and adult dugong and manatees applies to stellar sea cows, then a baby stellar sea cow would be as large or larger than its mom, right? That's a pretty serious size constraint. There will also be environmental controls about what will happen. So we know that we and every organism are not just a product of our genome sequences, but we're a product of our DNA sequence and the environment in which we are reared. If we were our DNA sequences alone, then identical twins would be absolutely identical in every way. And all of us know identical twins that are not. And as identical twins get older, they become less and less physically and behaviorally similar to each other. And this is because the environment and the things that we're exposed to in our environment actually change the way our genes are expressed. And the effect of the environment on an organism begins before birth. So what would the effect of this newly engineered hybrid elephant mammoth be of being exposed to elephant pregnancy hormones and an elephant diet and being born to elephants and raised by elephants? Elephants often eat the dung of their moms soon after birth in order to establish that community of microorganisms that lives in their gut. So it would have a community of elephant gut microorganisms. It would live and be raised by elephants and consume whatever elephants eat in their captive breeding environments. And speaking of captive breeding, this brings to what I think is the biggest concern about mammoth de-extinction in particular, and that is that it would involve using elephants in captivity. Now, elephants, we know, do not fare particularly well in captivity. They often fail to reproduce, even with our help. If they do reproduce, they sometimes injure or even kill their young. Until we have better ideas about how to meet the physical and emotional needs of elephants in captivity, they shouldn't be in captivity, much less being used in experiments to bring mammoths back to life. Of course, every species that's a candidate for de-extinction will have different technical, ethical, and ecological challenges, and there may be other species where ethically it seems more reasonable to actually attempt to bring them back to life. And finally, it would be remiss of me not to mention and acknowledge and point out that the world is not the same as it was when many of these species went extinct. This here is the east coast of the U.S., and the lights obviously represent where we are. This is the native range of the passenger pigeon, which is another candidate species for de-extinction. I think it would be very challenging to find a place in the world where we could release a flock of passenger pigeons, in particular if we know, if we learn eventually that they did require billions of individuals to survive in the world as it is today. And as we're considering species as candidates for de-extinction, we need to be very aware of both why they went extinct, whether that's been fixed. If not, if we brought something back, it would probably quickly just go re-extinct. And also what the consequences of releasing those animals into the wild might be for species that are actually alive today. So can we bring stuff back to life? Well, we can't yet, but the technology is improving rapidly and developing rapidly, and more we're realizing that even if we can't bring something back that's 100% identical to a species that used to be alive, we might be able to use this technology to edit, genetically manipulate species that are alive today so that they contain some of these extinct traits. And there may actually be reason to do this. But a big open question really is, should we? And as the teams around the world that are thinking about bringing these species back to life are investigating the different technical and ethical and ecological challenges associated with each one, we are really all very much concerned with trying to really sort out for ourselves and for everyone else who might be involved in this why we might want to do this. And I'm going to end by stepping back and talking about mammoths once again, because I do think that there are several reasons why we might want to actually think about doing this for mammoths. And I'm going to pretend for a moment that there aren't any technical challenges and that we've done some magical stuff that means that we've gotten over all of the ethical problems associated with mammoth de-extinction, because I do think that if we could do that, there are some good reasons why we might want to think about this. The first is ecological. So there's a Russian scientist called Sergei Zimov who owns this big tract of land near his home in Chersky that he is calling Pleistocene Park. And he is preparing Pleistocene Park for the return of the mammoth and other Ice Age fauna. And in his preparations, he has so far introduced bison from Canada, horses from Mongolia, and about 5 different species of deer. And on Pleistocene Park, he's been performing some experiments to see how having these animals on the landscape is changing the park itself. So he has these fence enclosures where in some places he allows the animals to graze and in other places he doesn't. So on this side with the house, there are no grazing animals, and you'll see that there's really only one species of grass. It's not particularly productive, certainly not sufficiently productive to support this large population of grazing herbivores. On the other side, you can't see it very well, but there are tufts of green grass, and there is actually a diversity of species of forbs, flowering plants, and grasses that have started to come back in this area. It's important to note that this picture was taken in very early spring, which means that any little bits of green here that have survived have lasted the long Siberian winter, meaning that these animals, their presence alone on this habitat, has been sufficient over only a few years to cause this rich grassland to regenerate. By moving over the soil, by recycling nutrients, by trampling down that snow, turning everything up, they've actually caused this landscape to change back into the rich steppe tundra that used to be there during the Ice Ages. And not only is there sufficient habitat for the animals that he's actually put in his park, but other species like Saiga antelopes have actually come to the park to feed. Endangered species that are struggling to survive because there's not enough habitat for them. This, in my mind, is one of the most compelling reasons to think about using this technology. It's not the animals that we need back, but the interactions between the animals and the other animals and the plants and the entire ecosystem that have been gone since they went extinct that we're missing. And by restoring those interactions, this could potentially be a powerful new weapon in what should be a growing arsenal against the extinction crisis that we're undergoing today. The second reason is more sentimental. So few of us are willing to imagine a world without elephants. But Asian elephants are endangered. Their habitat is declining. We're having trouble keeping them from being poached. What if we could use this technology not to bring back mammoths, but to genetically manipulate elephants so that they could survive in colder habitats? We could then move elephants into other habitats that might be available to them and easier to protect, places in North America or Europe or Siberia, where elephants, mammoths, used to live. We could use this technology as a way of saving species that are endangered today. And this has actually come to be called genetic rescue. And this is what I think is the most compelling use of this technology right now and where the effort is really being invested to try to figure out how we might do this. One of the most interesting projects that's ongoing right now is a project by Revive and Restore, which is an organization out of Sausalito that's led by Ryan Phelan and Stuart Brand. And their aim is to bring together people who have lots of different ideas and perspectives on how this might work to see what we can do to not only bring extinct species back to life, but to use this technology to save species and ecosystems today. They have a really cool project with black-footed ferrets. So black-footed ferrets used to be really abundant across the North American plains, and now they're almost extinct. There was an extermination program about 20 or 30 years ago to try to get rid of these guys. In fact, we thought they were extinct. Everyone thought they were extinct, and then they found a small population of individuals. It's a small population, though, with almost no genetic diversity. And now there's a disease that's killing them, that they have no genetic defenses to fight. However, there are black-footed ferrets that are in museum collections and also in the Frozen Zoo in San Diego, which is this amazing repository of information, genetic information, tissue samples from species, endangered species and non-endangered species that has been collected over the last several decades. The Frozen Zoo has specimens of black-footed ferrets that were alive before this crash in population that led to the near extinction of this population. The intention of Revive and Restore is to develop ways to isolate the parts of the genome that provide defenses against diseases that might be invading, like the major histamine complex, from these frozen black-footed ferrets, and use this cut-and-paste technology to increase diversity at disease-fighting parts of the genome in populations of black-footed ferrets, potentially providing them with a mechanism based on evolution that happened in their own species to survive whatever is going wrong today. And this, to me, I think, is an incredibly compelling reason to think about this technology. It's scary. There's a lot of unknowns. It's risky. But it could be a powerful way to preserve diversity that we have on the planet today. Thank you very much for paying attention. And I'm sorry that went a little bit long, but I'm very happy to answer whatever questions you have. In the back and then up here. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just real quick. Our thanks to Beth for her discussion of how to clone a mammoth, the science of de-extinction. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor to questions. Please keep your questions short and make sure they're actually questions. And raise your hand and speak into the microphone as we are recording.
Are you working with Stuart Brand?
I am, yes. Ryan and Stuart are good friends and colleagues of mine. I've been working with them on several projects to provide some of the preliminary data that they would need to bring species back to life. I'm working with them on the passenger pigeon project. So a big open question is, did passenger pigeons actually require billions of individuals to be alive? And also, what resources did they use? Were they the kind of species that was distributing seeds and therefore causing forests to grow? Or were they just consumers of seeds and actually really destructive? And we don't know the answers to those yet. So we've been trying to generate genetic information and also learn a little bit about how these animals behaved. There's a student in my lab called Ben Novak who's working with them as well, and he's he's leading the passenger pigeon project, and he's been doing a lot of work to try to figure out what the animals ate and didn't eat, what the consequences of that were. There are other people in my group who've been sequencing the passenger pigeon genome, and we're starting to learn about how their populations might have fluctuated in size over time. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. That was a very interesting talk, and you certainly covered a lot of areas. Optimistically, and looking at the analogy with Neanderthals, two-part question. One is, since the Max Planck group has been able to sequence Neanderthal genome, can't you use the same methodology that they use to sequence the mammoth genome? Part two, in terms of your phase two, Neanderthals and Homo sapiens mated. And supposedly, if you have a common ancestor going back a million years or so, you can pull it off. I'm not sure why there's so much pessimism then about an African elephant carrying a mammoth fetus, because I assume that they have a common ancestor within a million years.
So yes, we use ancient DNA technology, the same that Svante Paabo's group at the Max Planck Institute did, and we've sequenced and assembled genomes of extinct horses and wolves and a few and bears and all sorts of animals we have been able to piece together these genomes for. There are several mammoth genomes that have also been sequenced and assembled. None of that work was done in my group, but there's a group at the Swedish Natural History Museum that sequenced a few mammoth genomes, and there's another group from Chicago that's done some sequencing of mammoth genomes. There's definitely information out there, and we are able to piece together these genomes. Mammoths, the second part of your question, mammoths and Asian elephants shared a common ancestor 5 to 6 million years ago, and this is a long time ago, but we do know that species, if there isn't any challenge to them reproducing, then they will. Polar bears and brown bears are commonly thought to be different species, but we know from research going on in my lab that whenever they run into each other, they mate and genes flow between them. Well, genes flow from polar bears into brown bears, but not the other way around. But that's an entirely long answer to a question there that I won't get into right now, but it's really cool. So we don't know. And I wouldn't say there's huge amounts of pessimism about taking a modified elephant genome to contain mammoth genes and putting it in an elephant. I think one of the biggest challenges of that is not actually the embryo or that embryo developing, but actually getting the pregnancy to establish. I know there's been a lot of work in zoos to try to try to make more elephants without doing any of the editing, but just doing somatic cell nuclear transfer, cloning of elephants, or in vitro fertilization. And I'm not aware of a huge amount of success. I think that there are many challenges of just making that technology, reproductive technology, work in elephants. And that's one of the biggest technical hurdles, not necessarily genetic differences, although we don't know what the consequences of those genetic differences would be. Like you, I'm not sure that there would be huge genetic consequences for only 5 or 6 million years of evolution.
Thank you so much for this talk. I just wanted to ask about what's the forefront of genetic rescue right now, and what are people thinking in the world about what there is to save? For instance, right now the vaquita in the Gulf of Mexico is this wonderful, beautiful creature, and there's only 50 left right now, and that's what they recorded this week. So with the urgency of all these, super almost extinct species, I'm wondering what's the priority for scientists and whether we can actually do it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the biggest challenge to using this technology right now is that we don't actually know what genes we would need to modify in order to rescue many of these species. So we are starting to have a huge number of genomes that have been sequenced and published. And if you got all of these genomes together and handed them to someone, it would be like handing them the phone books to every major city in the world without any of the names in it, right? So we don't know yet where all the genes are or what all the genes do. And at this point, that, and it's all sort of bioinformatics and comparative biology, trying to figure out what differences are between individuals within a population and whether those differences really mean something as far as the function of different genes. This is all very hard. Right now, at the forefront of genetic rescue, there's some really fascinating and exciting work being done by the Roslin Institute again. They're often at the forefront of this stuff. I heard today that on one of the listservs that I'm involved with, that they have actually created a pig, a domestic pig, that they've made a little change to that makes it much less susceptible to a type of virus that domestic pigs often get. And they found out what this genetic difference was by comparing domestic pigs, who are very susceptible to this virus, with wild boars, who are not susceptible to the virus, and were able, through painstaking genetic comparison, to hone in on this one gene, and in fact, one mutation in a gene that they found to be causative of this susceptibility to disease. And by introducing that gene into domestic pigs, they've created a breed of pig that doesn't get that disease. And that's kind of the forefront of this technology. And it's really fascinating. Another one that I heard today, which I thought was equally fascinating, is again from the Roslin Institute, but they've identified a mutation that causes cows not to form horns. And I don't know the specifics, this female cows. So in dairying, the cows are often dehorned, and the farmers don't like to do this. It has obvious welfare issues for the cows themselves. And so creating a breed through genetic manipulation of cows that doesn't grow them would be fantastic for the welfare of these cows that are kept for dairying. And so this is the kind of cool stuff that we're able to hone in on these days. And I think it's just going to start to grow exponentially as we learn what more and more of these genes do in genomes, as more and more genomes become available for this comparative analysis.
Went extinct in the first place.
So this is one of the questions that we've been addressing in my research for a long time. The last populations of mammoths to live were on two different places. Wrangel Island, off the coast of Siberia, they survived until around 3,000 years ago. People weren't there for a long time. And on the Pribilofs, which is a couple of islands that are in between Alaska and Siberia, in the middle of the Bering Strait, mammoths lived to about 5,000 or 6,000 years ago. And there were never any people on these islands. So there is a very stark and striking correlation between the persistence of mammoths and the absence of people. We know from from our research that the populations of mammoths started to decline in North America, and bison and horses, well before people had arrived. And probably these initial declines were a consequence of changes in the amount of habitat that were available to them. So over the last million to 2 million years, we've seen more than 20 massive shifts between cold glacial intervals and warmer interglacial periods. And when it's cold, there's generally one community of cold-adapted animals that lives. And when it's warm, there's a different community of warm-adapted animals that survive. And So this shift has happened lots of times over the last couple of million years. But these animals have survived. And the way that they've survived has probably been to identify habitats, pockets of isolated refugial habitat where cold-adapted species can go and hang out until it gets cold again, or where warm-adapted species can go and hang out until it gets warm again. The difference, the major difference between this most recent shift from cold to warm and many of the previous ones is that people were around. And maybe there weren't enough of us to go out and actually kill every single one of the mammoths that might have survived, but if they were all hiding out in pockets of very isolated refugial habitat because they were already stressed out because it was warm, and we knew where those pockets of isolated refugial habitat were, then it would have been much easier for us to find them and kill them. So I feel pretty strongly, and if you look at the timing of the disappearance of megafauna in different parts of the world, it always is strongly correlated with the appearance of people. In Australia, it happens much earlier. On places like Mauritius Island, where the dodo lived, it happened 25 years after the first people turned up on Mauritius Island. We're a pretty destructive species, humans.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. I was wondering, it's purely scientific. I was wondering how eukaryotic chromosomes, or do we know why eukaryotic chromosomes form as opposed to bacteria that have only one circle?
Wow, that's a really hard question. I'm not sure. This isn't the field of science that I'm in. I know that eukaryotes are incredibly different. Obviously, we have all of our DNA that's in a central nucleus, whereas bacteria and other things that aren't eukaryotic, prokaryotic organisms have a single circular bit of DNA that kind of floats around the cytoplasm of the cell. This was a very early evolutionary change, evolutionary diversification between things that became plants and animals and fungi and things that are single cellular. There's a group down in San Diego, Craig Venter's research group, who's actually been working to recreate microbial life, taking advantage of the relative simplicity of this bacterial prokaryotic life form and been able to piece together these long genomes and actually create a synthetic form of bacterial life. But no one has been able to do that yet for a eukaryotic organism that has chromosomes.
I was just wondering what is discussed in your book.
Everything that I've just talked about. So I talk a lot about the different technical, ethical, and ecological challenges that would be associated with bringing extinct species back to life. I talk a little bit about the kind of work that I do, and I tell personal stories about kind of the work that we do and field work that I've been on and stuff like that. So it's really meant for a non-scientific audience, a lay audience, and it's supposed to be an easy and hopefully fun and sometimes funny introduction to this kind of science. So hopefully you can go into it knowing hardly anything and come out of it thinking, oh, that was a fun thing to read and I might have learned a little bit of something. So that was my aim. Thank you.
And now for our last question.
I was just wondering, if you're using modern day species like the Asian elephant to identify genuine mammoth DNA from your, samples, how do you identify those genes that have diverged from the modern day species but are genuinely mammoth DNA?
That's a good question, and it's something that's very hard that people have been working quite a lot on. So with genes tend to evolve relatively slowly. So the differences between genes are probably going to be single nucleotide changes, single letter changes in the DNA code, and these will be pretty easy to identify. The challenge really might be if there was a huge duplication of a big part of a chromosome, or there's a whole rearrangement that happened that has some functional importance in mammoths compared to Asian elephants. If we don't know that this big duplication has happened, or that this big new and very different piece of DNA has somehow got stuck into that genome, then we aren't going to be able to identify it. We'll just think that the DNA that we get that should map to that is just another bit of that junk DNA that that we would otherwise throw away. This is likely to be a problem, but much more of a problem when you're trying to use very, very distantly related living organisms to sequence and assemble as maps to kind of piece together the ancient organism. Things that are pretty closely related, like Asian elephants and mammoths or humans and Neanderthals in particular, are probably going to be similar enough that we can find pretty much everything that's there. But if you're talking about using something that's 50 million years diverged or 100 million years diverged to try to assemble or as a scaffold onto which to map these ancient genomes, then that's hard. And we probably will miss some of the most important bits, because if there is something that's really different, one might imagine that that's actually pretty critical to making that extinct species look and act differently from the living species that we're using as a scaffold. Thank you.
Our thanks to Beth Shapiro. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening in the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.